Welcome back to the program. Throughout the history of America and its federalist system, different places, usually states, have personified both politically and economically the ethos of a particular era. New York would come to represent the economic boom of the 20s, and Chicago, with its big shoulders, the apotheosis of industrialization. California would represent post-war America and the dreams of the Golden Land with its promise of freedom and education and hope. Today, many would argue that Silicon Valley represents the future. But my guest, Erica Greider, thinks we need to look toward the Lone Star State, a place many of us instinctively look away from, but it may be a lot closer than we think to representing the future of America. Erica Greider is a senior editor at Texas Monthly. She's a correspondent for The Economist. Her writing has appeared in The New York Times, The Spectator, The Atlantic, and Foreign Policy. It is my pleasure to welcome Erica Greider here to talk about big, hot, cheap, and right, what America can learn from the strange genius of Texas. Erica Greider, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for that great introduction.
It's great to have you here. We have such misconceptions about Texas. I mean, certainly the political reality of the state today would, I think, come as a surprise to most people that have even a slightly open view of the state of Texas.
No, it's true, and there's a couple of different ways to look at it. I mean, one thing that I was aware of in writing the book was that, you know, sometimes you say Texas and mean Texas, the political unit, the government of the state, and sometimes you say Texas, meaning the people of Texas. And on a lot of issues, you look at polling data, the people of Texas don't have the same views that you hear expressed by our statewide leaders. So that was one aspect of it. And then another aspect was that even with the statewide leaders, or looking at the legislature, I think it's not quite where people think it is in a lot of respects. So, for example, you know, it's a Republican state. It has been for a long time. But it's much more of a business-focused state than a socially conservative state. I think that's kind of the biggest gap.
And yet, along with that, along with even Democrats having dreams of turning the state blue, given the demographics, something happens like Ted Cruz being elected that shifts the perception in that regard.
No, it's true. And Cruz, you know, I feel quite fond of Ted Cruz because as a journalist, he's really... he's really a pleasure for me. I look forward to covering him for years to come. And you know, I think that in some ways, even he, I see, is somebody who in some respects is part of this Texas tradition. I mean, he has this kind of stump speech about how he's a conservative because he believes small government is what creates mobility and creates opportunity for the 47%. And he's, you know, kind of said the last campaign, the 2012 elections, fell apart for Mitt Romney because of that comment about the 47%, and that was really just the wrong thing to say, and a horrible accident is how Cruz would characterize it. But then, you know, in other respects, he is kind of a sui generis figure for Texas. He also kind of, excuse me, jumped the line and emerged out of nowhere about a year ago on the political scene, so it's been kind of fun to watch him.
In many ways, there is the sense that Texans in general, I mean, painting with a broad brush, kind of like a perception of themselves in the rest of the country that may not be, in fact, true, but they like people thinking that about them.
Well, I think there's a certain amount of confidence and optimism Texans have, and when there's some pushback on that from other people, then I think Texans push back just as hard. And, you know, I think sometimes we are treated a little bit unfairly in the national in the national perspective. Occasionally you feel like we're being framed for things. But I think there's also kind of an almost joking side to it, that we like this sort of self-image we have as Texans, and it's fun to hear the kind of angst it elicits from some of our friends in other states.
There is another reality, and you touched on it a little bit before we went on the air, and talking about the size of the state of Texas. I mean, certainly in California, because of its size, it is arguably two or three different states, essentially. Talk about Texas and the way in which its size really makes it different in different parts of the state.
Well, it's a great question. And I think that, you know, one thing about the state that's kind of distinctive, Evan Smith, who's the editor of the Texas Tribune, has put it that it's the only state where, despite the fact that you have these huge cities, we have six of the 20 biggest cities in the country are in Texas, there's this sense of state identity that kind of supersedes all the city identities. So it's like this whole, the whole state is the city of Texas, in the sense that people think of that as their unit of where they live. But then, of course, there is tremendous distances you cover in the state, and there's a lot of regional variation. So I think that's one aspect of it. If you go to places like the Rio Grande Valley, it's still quite poor, even though up the road in Houston or in Austin, San Antonio, you see cities that are effectively, you know, modern, thriving, affluent, or increasingly affluent cities, middle-class cities, I guess. And then the other aspect is that even in the cities, there's this sense of space that you don't necessarily have in more dense urban areas. So Houston, which is the fourth biggest city in the country, is one of the least dense. It's about, I think it's less dense than Los Angeles, which is also pretty spread out compared to a New York or Philadelphia or Boston type city.
The other interesting thing about Texas and the way it does reflect the country today and may be the future in some respects is the demographics of the state, both in terms of its internal demographics, its border, and also the fact that there are so many people there now that have come from someplace else, much like California in the post-war years.
No, it's true. And that was part of your introduction, which I thought was so nice. And actually, one of the kind of nice things about doing this book tour is hearing how people in different states respond to it. I like these kind of historical takes. But you mentioned Silicon Valley has been kind of held as an example of the future of the country, and post-war California certainly has been also, or was at that time. And I was thinking of the Silicon Valley part because we had President Obama in Austin last week kind of touring some entrepreneurs and going to some economic development events. And one of the comments that came out of the pool reports was somebody who had said, you know, Silicon Valley is great, but it's not something that you can do anywhere else but Silicon Valley. It's kind of a perfect storm of having the capital there, having the research there, having the universities there, and having the entrepreneurs there. But what we're doing in Austin, which is a kind of smaller pool of capital, one university, is something that you can more easily extrapolate elsewhere. And I think his point was that this is the entrepreneur, not the president. I think his point was that because it's sort of an open state, it's cheap to move here, cheap to live here, cheap to buy a house here, cheap to open a business here. This is kind of a way for the middle class to advance its goals.
Which brings up the issue of Texas's economic growth, and it certainly has been ahead of most of the country in that regard. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's true, and I think that's part of why I wanted to write the book, was that we saw this period in the past, you know, 5 or 6 years where, of course, the national economy was in a pretty severe recession that it's subsequently struggled to come out of and is still struggling to come out of. And here in Texas, we, I think, felt some of that pinch, but we evaded the worst of it, which was a huge success story for the state, I think, and for people in the state. I mean, we elided a lot of distress. We didn't have the same housing crisis, same financial crisis, or same employment crisis that so many states dealt with during that period. And looking at the data, it's a very clear story. You see job growth in every industry, in every wage quartile. There's a lot of low-wage jobs that have been created, but also a lot of middle-wage jobs and high-wage jobs that have been created. You see growth in every city for the most part, and you do see parts of the state that are still lagging, like I mentioned, the valley and parts of rural Texas. But overall, you've seen this tremendous narrative of more or less across the board better economic outcomes than we've seen elsewhere.
The irony of not facing some of those crises is that, in fact, it came from state laws and legislation that was passed there that seems to run counter to this idea of limited government.
No, it's true. And, I guess the thing is, it's limited government, but it's never been a no-government state. And we've seen kind of moments in history where the state's taken a pretty strong hand in response to things. Another example is the oil industry. We've had we had some laws in place before we even had oil discovered in Texas in quantity, antitrust laws, for example, that were kind of meant as a protectionist measure against northeastern industrial interests like the banks and the railroads. When we discovered oil, those laws were used to keep a lot of the oil wealth in the state of Texas, which ended up being pretty fortuitous. We then had a pretty strong regulatory commission that was overseeing production in the great fields in Texas. And then more recently, with the housing crisis, part of why we missed that was that we had put in pretty strict lending restrictions. So when you look at actually the numbers now, I have a form somewhere. I'll leave it in the file cabinet. But we still have one of the lowest foreclosure rates, in the country. We also correspondingly have a pretty high rate of people who are unbanked, underbanked, and who don't have access to credit. So those things are related, and it's kind of the flip sides of the same coin. I mean, on the one hand, it's good for people to have access to credit and ways to build wealth, but on the other hand, at least we avoided the fact that people were getting too much credit and getting underwater. So.
And even though Texas is still very much reliant on oil as a driver of the economy, even in the areas of alternative energy, particularly wind power, Texas has moved ahead of a lot of other places in the country.
Right, it's true. And I think, I mean, oil is definitely still an important driver of the economy. It's less important than it once was, both in terms of state GDP and employment. And actually, employment effects for oil are pretty small. It's a capital-intensive rather than labor-intensive industry. But I think it's kind of one of the reasons I would say it's a pretty pragmatic state. You have the sense in Texas that if we are the oil and gas state, we're also the energy state. And that's led to movements. Occasionally in the legislature, they've supported the development of these industries. And in the cities, saying, well, we're also going to do wind power. We're going to install more wind power than any other state. And we're going to do efficiency. And we're going to look at solar. Solar's kind of lagged compared to wind. And we're going to do shale gas, which I think is better in some respects than some of the older fossil fuels. So there's this this tendency to kind of put the pragmatic side of things ahead of the ideological side of things in Texas.
There certainly are a lot of places in the country, as you've alluded to, that look down on Texas. Where do Texans look down on? When Texans look around the country, what are the places that they put down?
Well, we don't really put anyone down. It's funny. People do seem to feel quite frustrated by Texas. I don't think we're a bad neighbor, though. I think there's been plenty of times when we tease a lot California. Illinois has been kind of the kind of trending state that Texans make fun of. I've actually, I don't really make fun of California or Illinois. I think they're both nice states. but I think that Texans in general, there's a little bit of this sort of, you know, trash talking to each other, but it's at least on our end, pretty well-intentioned. And, you know, we've seen, for example, during moments of disaster, like during Hurricane Katrina, the state was, I think, a huge asset to neighboring Louisiana as far as resources it provided and people it took in after the storm. So we're meant to be a friendly state. It's one of our state values.
I want to talk a little bit about people that have personified Texas lately and the impact that George W. Bush had on people's mm-hmm. perception of the state of Texas. And the impact that Rick Perry's aborted presidential campaign had on perceptions of Texas.
Oh, it's true. You know, ever since the Rick Perry oops debate, I've been so paranoid about forgetting any fact or anything in a list of items when I'm doing these interviews. I feel like then it'll just only worsen this impression that Texans can't remember simple lists of things. But yeah, certainly those two have corroborated an impression of Texans that people maybe already had. I think that in some respects, the critiques of both have been fair, and some they really haven't been, you know. And to me, the kind of issue with this sort of large-scale derision of these figures, whatever your politics are, I mean, I don't see the point in kind of casting someone aside when there are, in fact, good things about the record that you could sort of look back to and say, well, they meant well on this, they tried on this, or maybe this was a good idea, even though the rest of that person's ideas were horrible. So with both of those two, I think it's a mix of how much they deserved compared to how much flack they got.
Certainly the one thing that has been dramatic for Republicans in the state of Texas is the degree to which they have gotten Latino support, far, far more than in any other part of the country. Talk a little bit about what's behind that.
Sure, and that's kind of part of what I was thinking of with both Bush and Perry about things that have been good in their record. You know, it's not really an accident. For a variety of reasons, Texas Republicans have historically been more moderate on immigration than their national counterparts. And it's not it's not the only issue that Hispanic voters care about, of course. Most Hispanics in the United States are not immigrants, but I think it certainly gives an impression of where the party's at. And I think that in Texas, for historical reasons, cultural reasons, economic reasons, and then simple political reasons and demographic reasons, the state GOP has not really gone out of its way to offend Hispanic voters and has done a fair amount more of outreach. And so the result has been that I think Democrats typically still win the Hispanic vote in Texas, but it's by a much narrower margin than, for example, what we saw with Romney and Obama last time, where Obama won about 75% of the Hispanic vote, I think, according to exit polls. In Texas, maybe it seems like when we have exit polls, which we don't always have, it's about 55-60, which is a noticeable difference.
Certainly in the gun debate, Texas keeps coming up as a place where everybody has, and you talk about this in the book, a place where everybody has the perception that there isn't a single person in the state of Texas that's not carrying.
There's a lot of us who aren't. I'm not. I don't think anyone in the office right now, Texas Monthly, is. I could be wrong. It's a state that has a pretty robust gun culture, I guess, or kind of an interest in guns. We don't actually have any data in any state about who owns guns, how many guns are owned. That's one of the kind of gaps in our gun data around the country. But we do have figures about number of people who have CHLs, concealed handgun licenses, because most states allow those. Texas does. And then if you have one of those, you can use that as sort of a rough proxy for how many guns might be in the state or comparing gun rates per capita. And we're actually quite low for that, which I think is not because people don't like guns or aren't interested in guns, but it's just a function of urbanization, right? So 80% of Texans live in cities. People who live in cities typically don't have hunting rifles in their house. And that's true around the country, including in Texas.
I want to talk about so many people moving to Texas, and it's part of the economic success story that we talked about before. But I wonder what impact it's going to have over the long run as there are more and more people that come to Texas that are not imbued with the Texas creation story and the sense of what it means to be a Texan. What impact is that going to have on the state?
No, it's a great question. I've been asked this question a lot with varying degrees of concern by Texans, too. We've seen it happen before, actually. If you look back to the 70s, which is the decade when the state started to switch from being a one-party Democratic state to a one-party Republican state, that there had been a similar influx of Republicans or of people from other states coming to the country, coming to Texas, and a lot of them were sort of Northeastern Republicans who then became Texas Republicans. But I think this kind of growth has been part of the state's history for a long time. I mean, every census, decade on decade, we've seen population growth in Texas. This last one, 2000-2010, has been a big one, about 4 million people, so we're now 26 million. And of course, that'll mean some shift in potentially state culture, state politics, but I think that as far as state identity goes, there's a self-selection effect, right? You move to Texas, you want to be here, you want to stay here once you get here, and people become, I think, sort of enamored of the state history, and they learn about it later, and they, I think, come to appreciate the state more once they're here. I think that's true even for visitors. Often you see visitors who come somewhat skeptically and then leave very happy at the end of the week about how much nicer and less gun-toting we are in person.
And yet, from a demographic perspective, the state is getting younger, it's getting more Hispanic, as we've talked about, and getting more urbanized.
Yeah, no, it's true. I think that the age factor is really the one that I've been talking about most with demographics, because ethnicity is getting the most attention, but ethnicity in Texas and in the United States is correlated with age. So with the youth of the state, you think, okay, well, that means things like we have 8% of the population of the country, but 10% of the school-age children in the country. So that's going to point to the need for things like more school funding, maybe more schools being built, eventually more universities, more community colleges. So I think that's the kind of thing that could push Texas to do things a little bit differently. I don't think we're going to leave the Texas model, but if you're talking about making investments for the state's future workforce, I think that that's something Texans will be willing to do because it makes sense.
Talk about the focus on business, even to the exclusion within the political landscape of social issues sometimes.
Yeah, that's been such a funny one. It's like sometimes the business interests or even the lobbyists are kind of moderating influence on the Tea Party or the religious right type Republicans in Texas. In some ways, they're quite good citizens, the business interests. And you even hear occasionally Democrats, progressives, saying that. I remember Molly Ivins' comment about how Ross Perot is one of our best right-wing billionaires in Texas. And they do take a pretty active role. But the thing is, the state, I think, has always had this view of, we're not going to be a big government state. Therefore, we're not going to be able to do a lot to help you. We don't have a big safety net. But you know, if you can take care of yourself, then that's going to be fine for you. And that kind of implicit social compact is still what the state works with. And so that's why this focus on jobs and economic development has been so huge for the state. And we'll see in a variety of ways, the state supports business, not just business like fat cats, but there's a special focus on, I think, Texas business, on businesses that create jobs, on jobs that are good jobs and jobs that are in growth kind of clusters. So there's a fair amount of industrial policy that happens as far as subsidies and incentives and you know, investments like in education to bring certain types of industry to parts of the state. And then on the second side of that, the way that business interests kind of mitigate the other parts of the Republican Party, you see things like on immigration, for example, we don't use E-Verify. We're one of the states that doesn't require that, and it's partly because, well, you have a big unauthorized workforce in the state. It's not really going to do anybody any good, the employers or the unauthorized immigrants themselves, to be especially punitive about it, since they're already here and they're working.
What are the dangers to the current level of economic growth? If there were to be a slowdown, what might trigger that?
You know, it's an interesting question. There used to be a sense, I think, in previous national downturns that Texas was sort of countercyclical and that we were slow to get into a recession, but slow to get out of it. We've already seen, I think, in this time that it's not the case, that the state's pretty well diversified. So we've, I think, come out of the recession. We've regained the jobs that were lost. We're back to kind of where we were before and still growing. But I think at some point you think there might be a slowdown just because, you know, you don't keep posting growth rates indefinitely, nor do you necessarily need to, I don't think. I mean, at some point, if your population is not growing, you don't need the same kind of job growth, right? So I think that if that kind of slowdown happens on both fronts, economic growth and population growth, it'll be okay. It'll be pretty manageable because a lot of the jobs that have been kind of built into the state now are pretty good jobs and ones that will stick around. Maybe the biggest risk actually is going to be the sort of psychological effect of, wait, what happened to us? We just stopped, you know, adding jobs so much. We actually, I think in March, the state lost about 4,000 jobs, which was one of the only months in the past few years where the state has lost any net jobs. And it didn't affect the overall employment rate because the state's workforce is about 11 million people, but it was still a kind of moment of pause, like, what, we lost 4,000 jobs. How can that be?
Of course, the corollary of that is the extent to which, if there is a slowdown, without the social safety nets in place and a growing population, more and more people moving there, what the impact of that might be.
Well, I think the idea is that if there's a slowdown, then the people moving there will pause, or will at least slow down pretty precipitously, too. So it's not going to be quite the same effect of people pouring in while we're not able to generate more jobs for them. And actually, we've seen a little bit over the past 10 years or so, the population's grown every year. The employment number, the total, has grown almost every month. And so unemployment's wavered a bit and got a little bit higher, but partly because of the growth of the workforce rather than any job losses. So I think, you know, what will kind of people turn to then? If there's that kind of slowdown that affects people facing huge layoffs, then we'll see more more political pressure, more duress. But I think that as long as there's a pretty healthy jobs outlook, which there will be, we'll be okay. It's funny. I mean, this is a good question because we haven't seen in the past 10 years any period of enough losses where it became a going issue, the issue that you're pointing towards.
Mm-hmm. Is there a sense in Texas that it is the anti-California, that California in many ways is the antithesis of the way Texas operates?
There's certainly been this sort of Texas versus California kind of meme that goes around. You can kind of look at it as a red state versus blue state meme. And I think that part of the reason we did a comparison is these are the two biggest states, the two most, in terms of population, they're the two states that are young, that are ethnically diverse, that have a kind of big urban population, but also a big rural population that have a lot of space to cover, as we touched on all those things before. I've been doing more of a Texas versus Massachusetts comparison lately as far as talking about policy, because I think that because California is California and it has this kind of, you know, incredible and more or less unique set of natural resources, the coastline, the access to the sea, this kind of historic standing as California, it's a little bit of a skewed example. I think that if we look at maybe, you know, Massachusetts or Maryland, they're kind of more paradigmatic. Here's a blue state model. It's high taxes, high spending, slower growth, but you don't need so much growth because you don't have a population growth. It's older, it's affluent, it's more educated. So their kind of goal with the model is to sort of maintain the prosperity and the stability that they've had for a long time. At this point, the Texas versus California comparison, you know, I mean, to be honest, I'm not an expert in why California's outcomes are the way they are right now, but it seems like in a lot of measures, including things like schools, Texas is posting better outcomes than California. And so, you know, I'm not sure how California will go forward, but maybe, you know.
I think you could make an interesting case that both states could learn a lot from each other if everything else were put aside and there was an objective view of it all.
No, that's true. And I think that, you know, one debate I've had with people in Texas who are in politics is the kind of John Rawls question of, you know, if you don't know where you're going to be born and you don't know what your parents' income is going to be or what your health is going to be, are you better off being born somewhere like California or somewhere like Texas? And I'm actually not sure what the answer to that is. I'm not sure, but that's, I think, another way of looking at the question that's thought-provoking.
Erica Greider, her book is Big, Hot, Cheap, and Right, What America Can Learn from the Strange Genius of Texas. It's just out from Public Affairs. Erica, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.